Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We're going right back to our exclusive broadcast of a briefing for international media by Lester Brown, founder of the Earth Policy Institute and formerly of World Watch. Lester explains the converging trends which guarantee higher food prices for all of us and more foodless days for millions of the world's poorest people.
One of the interesting questions that we now face in this country is, was this year's drought a one-time thing? Is it going to stand alone in the historical trend? Or is it a manifestation of climate change, and may we see several consecutive years of drought in the future? We don't know. It makes you a little queasy just to think about the possibility of droughts like the one we had this year being strung together in consecutive years. Agriculture, as we know it today, has evolved over an 11,000-year period of rather remarkable climate stability. Agriculture, as it exists today, has evolved to maximize production with that climate system. But that climate system is no more. And now, with each passing year, the agricultural system and the climate system are more and more out of sync with each other. And that's going to take a toll on harvests in many countries around the world from year to year, with the toll likely growing larger. So we have water shortages and we have climate change. We also have soil erosion. We've been overplowing and overgrazing in recent decades to the point where there are now two massive new dust bowls forming, one in northwestern China and western Mongolia, the other in Central Africa. Dust bowls are not new. We had a dust bowl in the 1930s, but we were able to get it under control by taking some of the more vulnerable land out of production, putting it back in grass, by strip cropping, by planting tree windbreaks. So our dust bowl was short-lived, just for a matter of years during the 1930s. Then the Russians had a dust bowl the Soviets in the late 50s and early 60s. They overplowed, and much of that overplowing was in what is now Kazakhstan. They pulled back, and that situation stabilized. In some countries in the world, soil erosion has reached the point where it is reducing harvests. This is true in Mongolia and Lesotho, for example. In both countries, grain production is falling as the soil blows away. In Haiti, production is not falling, but grain production is not increasing either. And that's because soil erosion is occurring on a scale there that enables it to offset any advances in technology or investments in agriculture. So in addition to water shortages, climate change, and soil erosion, we now have a new constraint on world grain production. It's what I call the glass ceiling on grain yields. For the last half century or more, all the agriculturally advanced countries have been raising their wheat yield per acre, their rice yield per acre, their corn yield per acre. And now suddenly, in recent years, some of the more agriculturally advanced countries have sort of hit this glass ceiling and they can no longer raise their yields. Japan and South Korea both hit the ceiling with rice yields, Japan about 15 years ago and South Korea not too long after that. But they've not raised yields at all over this past decade or so. We have a similar situation in Europe, where wheat yields have plateaued in France, Germany, and the UK. These are the three leading wheat producers in Western Europe. Wheat yields have not increased for at least a decade there. And it's not that farmers in Japan, rice farmers in Japan or wheat farmers in France don't want to keep raising yields. It's just that there are no technologies now to take them any further. So this glass ceiling, I call it a glass ceiling because we didn't know exactly where it was. We knew we couldn't raise yields forever, but now we're seeing where the limits are. We have a lot of factors on the demand side that are expanding demand for grain worldwide at a record rate, double the rate of a decade ago. On the supply side, we have these new constraints, emerging water shortages, climate change, soil erosion, and the discovery of this glass ceiling on yields in the more agriculturally advanced countries. These make it more difficult to eradicate hunger, to respond to the concept of food foodless days that we now see popping up in so many developing countries. If I were to pick one economic indicator that I think will tell us more than any other about our future, it would be the price of food. The price of food, I think, will tell us more about the future of civilization than any other single indicator. The question then is, what do we do? How do we deal with this threat of tightening food supplies and continually rising food prices? Well, one of the things we can do is raise water productivity. It is water, not land, that is now restricting the growth in world food production. There's a lot of land in the world that would produce food if there was enough water to go with it. So raising water productivity becomes a major goal. It should be similar to the one we adopted beginning in the 1950s, when we realized that world population was going to double by the end of the century. And we also realized that even then, there wasn't much new land to plow. So we had to raise land productivity. So we did a number of things: international research cooperation, production incentives for farmers, and we ended up doubling world grain yields between 1950 and 2010. We tripled grain land productivity. We now need to think about how to do something like that with water. So number one on the what-to-do list, raise water productivity. Number two, we need to rebuild grain reserves. The guide for adequate grain reserves that was set by FAO probably 30, 40 years ago was that carryover grain stocks, that is, the amount in the bin just as the new harvest begins, should be at least 70 days of consumption. At the end of this year, they're going to be below 70 days. We don't know how much yet. But at a time when we're facing climate change and the instability of extreme weather events, whether it's droughts or floods or fires or whatever, I think we need a lot more than 70 days. I think we need 110 days of carryover stocks to ensure future food price stability. So the second thing, I think we need to rebuild world grain reserves. The third thing we need to do is to stabilize climate, and that means cutting carbon emissions fast. In our Plan B for what we need to do about these problems in the world, the book Plan B, we talk about cutting carbon emissions, the need to cut carbon emissions, 80% within the next decade. Not by 2050, which is what political leaders like to talk about. We don't use 2050 because we think the game will be over long before then. But it does mean that if we cut carbon emissions 80% in the next decade, it's going to take something like a World War II mobilization to do that. It's doable. It's entirely doable. We have the technologies now to do it. But we don't yet have the policy commitments on a scale to make that possible. The other thing we need to do is stabilize population. And that means eradicating poverty. As economist Jeffrey Sachs has pointed out, for the first time in history, we have the resources to eradicate poverty in the world. The exciting thing about doing that is that it's the key to stabilizing population. The two principal components of an effort to stabilize world population well before we reach the projected 9 billion is, one, make sure that women everywhere have access to family planning service. There are millions of women who want to plan their families but do not have access to family planning services. The amount of expenditure to fill that family planning gap is so small, it would get lost in the rounding of the U.S. defense budget. But it is a major threat to future food security for people throughout the world. So we know what needs to be done. Raise water productivity, build up grain reserves, dramatically cut carbon emissions, and stabilize population as soon as possible. We know what to do, but we're not doing a very good job on anyone of those four counts. And interestingly, two of them fall within the responsibility of ministries of agriculture: raising water productivity, because 80% of all the water we use in the world is for irrigation, and rebuilding grain reserves. The other two big things, cutting carbon emissions and stabilizing population, lie with the Ministry of Energy and with the Ministry of Health and Family Planning. They are outside agriculture, but they are important to the solution of the problem to the eradication of hunger.
That was Lester Brown, founder of the Earth Policy Institute. He was speaking about his new book, Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. This presentation for the media was recorded on September 27, 2012. There are mysterious gardens appearing in Canada's poorest urban neighborhood, Vancouver's downtown east side. And why is a business group pushing local food? Our guest is Wes Regan, executive coordinator of the Hastings Crossing Business Improvement Association in Vancouver, Canada. Wes toured internationally as an actor and musician before becoming an urban geographer. He's a founding member of the Vancouver Urban Farming Network and the Urban Aquafarm Society. Wes, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'd like to start with a little patch of vacant land I've seen in an area known for poverty and drug abuse. It's squeezed between two old buildings, this lot on Hastings Street. It used to be covered in garbage. Now it's got food on it. Can you tell us about that urban garden?
Yeah, there's a couple of them on Hastings Street. There's three. One of them is growing commercially. That one's further down near the Astoria, and that's a soul food plot. One of them is the Insight Community Garden, which is akin to horticultural therapy, really, and that's there for some of the residents in the area who use Insight. And the third one, which is right across from Save-On Meats, is a project that's been put together by the Portland Hotel Society, and they're growing food there for their meal program in some of the SROs and some of the other social housing that they manage there in the neighborhood. So three different growing spaces, and three different reasons or three different mandates behind those spaces as well.
Well, our American audience wouldn't know what Insight is, and they wouldn't know what SROs are, so why don't you expand on that?
Well, Insight is the first safe injection site for intravenous drug users in North America. It follows the European model of harm reduction. The philosophy is that by having a safe place to discard of needles or having a safe place to inject where someone can supervise you, the risk of either sharing needles and transmitting a bloodborne pathogen or overdosing from poor quality drugs or too much of a dose is mitigated, and therefore the public health concerns around addiction in that part of the city are over the long term improved, and over the short term too, could be argued. SROs, single room occupancy, and those are essentially, you know, they're hotel rooms basically, but oftentimes they lack amenities, even basic amenities such as bathrooms. So they'll have a small space with barely any room for cooking your own food or even a refrigerator, and they'll be shared bathrooms. A lot of them are in pretty poor condition, and food security in Vancouver's downtown east side, similar to other cities around North America, is obviously a major concern. It's a food desert, or in some places can be considered a food swamp, in which there's just nothing but junk food, essentially. So growing food in these gardens, especially food that can be accessed while it's still fresh, doesn't need to be refrigerated or prepared, really, those are good options for people that really don't have a lot of, you know, cooking technology, so to speak.
Well, as you're saying, some downtown Eastside residents have seen their share of problems, along with the newly arriving condo owners. There's a mix of alcoholics, drug addicts, the disabled, the unemployed, people who've been disadvantaged or even abused. Some are First Nations people. Do you find many willing gardeners, and what is the personal impact for them of having a space to grow?
Yeah, I think one of the most powerful examples of the social or cultural benefits of growing food is really soul food. That's a great project in particular that I think they now have four or five sites in the downtown east side. And for them, it was seen not only as a way to improve food security in the area, but also a way to create, I guess, what we could call culturally appropriate jobs, which are jobs that are attainable for residents with barriers to employment that might not be able to work in a, you know, high-end cafe as a barista or something like that. But they can still enjoy getting their hands in the dirt, planting and tending to those vegetables or bringing them to market and stuff like that. So, and not, you know, not on 9 to 5 hours. Like, it's a more flexible sort of human resources model, if you will, where they can work the amount that they can work when they can work, and soul food finds a way to accommodate all those residents and meet them where they are in their lives, meet them halfway. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of residents in the downtown east side who are eager to see better food in the community and are also eager to see opportunities for for employment, you know, to add a little extra income. Recently, the government softened some of their policies or laws around clawbacks on welfare. So residents are actually able to make a few hundred more dollars a month now. I think it's at least $200 extra in cash. It might even be as high as $8, I think, you know. I mean, that's a step in the right direction. But now we need the types of jobs that, you know, residents that have encountered those difficulties in their lives, you know, are able to feasibly take on. So urban agriculture and a couple of other green-collar jobs were identified a few years ago as good areas to be looking into in regards to that.
Well, I want to ask a question on behalf of all the urban and really the suburban people. Don't hungry people, drunks, and vandals just steal the food or wreck the gardens?
No, actually, there's... I haven't heard of any cases of that happening, and I think it's partly because there's a strong sense of community ownership over those spaces or those places. There's less stigmatization around that part of the city, and I think just inner cities in general throughout North America as places where lawless and self-interested people with no morals are just kind of wandering around looking for the next fix and stuff like that.
No. That's Wall Street you're talking about.
Yeah. That's true. But it's incredible just how much social capital actually exists in these low-income communities. It is people that have learned how to struggle together. And when a community, you know, whether they're a high-income community or a low-income community, learns how to struggle together, that creates a lot of trust and it creates a lot of genuine dialogue about the human condition in general. And so there's a lot of, you know, respect in the neighborhood. There's respect for murals, you know, graffiti murals have been put up. There's respect for little renegade gardens or just little renegade placemaking features that have not been city sanctioned. It's just the community's way of placemaking, if you will. And so these gardens have, to the best of my knowledge, never had an incidence of vandalism or theft. And oftentimes people will walk by, particularly the Soul Food spot, which is near the Astoria Hotel, they'll walk by and they'll lean up on the fence and they'll start talking to the farmers and asking them about the food. And Sean Dory, the coordinator there at Soul Food, has tons of stories of people just randomly popping by and getting in a conversation about food and sustainability and the community and gentrification and just another example of the social and cultural binding ability of food growing and food eating, for that matter.
And too often, we think of business as being hostile to green initiatives, but you coordinate the local business improvement association. How did that unlikely marriage come about?
I was working for a community economic development agency 2009-2010, and the green-collar job creation, I think as I alluded to earlier, was identified as one of those areas where we could see a lot of entrepreneurial growth and a lot of job growth. And just serving a variety of needs, whether it's retrofitting buildings, putting in, you know, elastomeric white roofs or green roofs, and looking at things like urban agriculture, waste diversion, remanufacturing, all those sorts of things. And we have a strong green cluster already in the downtown east side. It's mostly centered in Strathcona. But when I transferred over from that agency, I had been helping a group of businesses, a lot of them very socially progressive, environmentally responsible businesses, to form this BIA. And the philosophy behind it was that if businesses that didn't have a more compassionate or empathic approach to their role in the community would do this, then some other businesses that didn't have quite as altruistic goals would come by and do it, and that would probably just increase the pace of gentrification and displacement and cause more tension in the community. So they asked me if I wanted to sort of segue over from my role with building opportunities with business when my contract finished there. And I thought, yeah, I think this is a great opportunity to try and form a business improvement area and really do it differently. I think we're really trying something unique. We'd like to call ourselves the Social Innovation BIA. The trick is to bring value for money to our stakeholders, which are the businesses and property owners. But in so doing that, we're trying to connect that to more community capacity building opportunities, job creation for residents, and any sort of sustainability improvements in the neighborhood, both environmentally, culturally, and socially and economically. So the whole picture, we're looking for broad net positive gains for multiple stakeholders, not just the businesses and properties, but that's where we start.
Wes, please tell us a little bit about the Vancouver Urban Farming Network.
Yeah, in 2010, it was October, part of that research into looking into those green-collar job areas that we were looking to create jobs through, we identified several people that were farming, and we decided to do some research into who was doing what, how much they were growing, you know, what really were the job creation opportunities there. And so the more and more that we kept on getting together, the more it kind of turned into an informal network. And so we started having events where we'd be sharing information about what the various farmers were doing, what was working, what wasn't, sort of best practices and stuff. And we were identifying gaps in policy or land use and planning areas where we thought that the city could be engaged by the farmers in order to create a better environment, a regulatory and policy environment for urban farming to grow here. And so we held a forum in November of 2011, and the findings from that forum have helped inform the city of the types of policies and types of regulations that would enable urban farming. And the farmers themselves have continued to come together, and we've collectively formed the Vancouver Urban Farming Society now, which is the official society that we come around in order to continue that advocacy work and that capacity building work in the urban farming sector. There's about 23 farms now, most of them growing for commercial purposes, but some of them for social justice or, you know, just neighborhood community purposes. But most of them are commercial, and a lot of them are very highly educated and experienced people. So it's a really fun, really smart group to be working with, and it's been incredible to see it just continue to grow.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, talking with Wes Regan, urban farmer and executive coordinator of the Business Improvement Association in Vancouver's poorest neighborhood called the Downtown East Side. Wes Regan, you're also part of the Urban Aquafarm Society. Are there really aquaculture operations in the city of Vancouver?
That's a tricky one. The yard conversions, you know, growing vegetables in the front yards and backyards, and you know, anything that's not involving animal husbandry is generally a lot easier to get up and running here in town. There are a few groups. There's a consortium that's working up at UBC that's bringing together, you know, not just aquaponics, but also closed containment aquaculture advocates from around the province. And there was a group, Backyard Bounty, that had a few aquaponics setups in town here. Britannia Elementary School was one site where they had one of their demonstration projects, and they've got a couple of backyard barrel ponic setups throughout the city. But we think that Urban Stream, which is the company that I'm a partner in, once we get one of our units up and running, it's going to be, I think, the first example of a true commercial-scale aquaponics operation here in Vancouver, similar to, you know, Will Allen's aquaponics setups there out in Wisconsin.
And how do you picture aquafarms contributing to the cities of the future?
I don't think the farmers themselves even would delude ourselves that we're going to grow all the food that a city needs here in the urban environment, at least not with current practices and technologies. That's definitely a ways off. You know, there's projects like Dixon DePalmier's vertical farm project. He's out of Columbia University there in New York. And they have these crazy utopian technological futurists, you know, charrettes of these huge skyscrapers that are growing food and have like mini contained ecosystems and stuff like that. And those are obviously massively capital intensive, billions of dollars going into that. And it's just not likely, especially with today's economic climate, that that's going to be the path forward, I don't think. Maybe down the road a ways. So in the case of Urban Stream, we use more of an aggregate strategy where we have shipping containers that are placed throughout the city that are almost operating at a district scale, not a citywide scale. So we're looking at a more diffuse approach to creating food sort of neighborhood by neighborhood. And I think that there's a place for aquaponics in that matrix, if you will, because protein is really, I think, one of those key areas where cities and food security are not going to be adequately met. The dietary needs are not going to be met if we don't have protein in there. So aquaponics is just one of those areas where I think it's a natural, possibly even makes more sense than chickens and larger, you know, livestock and stuff. I think it actually makes a lot of sense in that regard. I don't have a lot to do with the community gardens. There's a pretty big, clear distinction between the urban farmers who are growing for predominantly commercial reasons and the urban community garden plots.
You and I know Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robinson and his council are supportive. They want to make Vancouver the greenest city in the world. But how could we make this same case to less sympathetic municipal governments?
I think in the end boils down to the cost-benefit analysis for them, because I don't think you can appeal to particularly the conservative governments on a emotional or even perhaps even a moral basis for why we need to make a transition to a more sustainable urban food system and be looking at these sort of things. But I think if you approach it on a cost-benefit analysis and you demonstrate how cities in the long run are actually going to be more fiscally responsible if they're reducing the cost associated with the externalities of an unsustainable food system or an unsustainable urban framework, period, then hopefully, no matter what your ideological leanings, the numbers will make sense, and cities will start to make that transition. And so the goal for Vancouver, I think, has been and will continue to be to clearly quantify those positive impacts or those positive externalities that are created by these policy changes and by these initiatives.
And also, as you say, it helps to bring back some people who have been kind of, I wouldn't say outsourced, but just shut out of society by creating these green-collar jobs and getting things reintegrated. It's got to be good for the community.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the economy has seen such sweeping transitions in the past 30 years away from manufacturing to services and now to really the creative sector or lifestyle economy. And so in that transition, I mean, that's a really short period of time where we've seen a huge shift in the nature of work in cities. And so we have a lot of cities where I think men, middle-aged men in particular, are caught kind of between a rock and a hard place. And it's really a lot of those middle-aged men, that not men in particular, but people that have been caught, you know, in this transition. And they've been, I think, further alienated by not being able to keep up, you know, not being able to get the training in order to work in the high-tech sector or the creative sector, or lacking the sort of cultural awareness or the lack of even language, you know, that helps them to integrate through those changes. There's only so much tertiary consumer goods that a city can create before it reaches a point where you have diminishing returns culturally and economically on the output of that area. And so looking back to the essentials, looking at food, looking at shelter, looking at even transportation and distribution throughout the urban environment, those are sort of basic bread and butter jobs that keep a city functioning smoothly. And I think that there's a lot of job creation opportunity there, tons of job creation opportunity around food, around better dealing with our waste, whether it's recyclables or whether it's things like deconstruction, whether it is organic food scraps and how we can tap into the, you know, the reusable outputs of that. And so, yeah, I think that all in all, you know, this is a transition, I would hope, to an economy that's more inclusive, because it's offering more opportunities for a more diverse labor pool to engage in meaningful work that's going to make the community better. Yeah, definitely. I think there's a great opportunity to engage residents of our communities who have been shut out of the labor market because of the changing nature of work. I think we're seeing it change again, only this time it's going to be more inclusive and more inviting.
Well, I'll put some links to some of the things we've been talking about in my show blog at ecoshock.info, but can you give us a couple of web, Twitter, or Facebook places for our listeners to follow up?
Yeah, if they're interested in a little bit more about what's going on with the urban farming movement here in Vancouver, urbanfarmers.ca is a website they can head to. And if they are curious about what is going on in the inner city in regards to local economic development, some of the projects that Hastings Crossing BIA is involved in, hxbia.com. And they can follow the Hastings Crossing Twitter account at hxbia as well.
We've been talking with Wes Regan, Executive Coordinator of Hastings Crossing Business Improvement Association in downtown Vancouver, Canada. Wes, thank you so much for helping us out.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Download this program and many more at our website, ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.